Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. Sean Price Williams and Nick Pinkerton have been guests on the podcast before, sharing their encyclopedic viewing habits. But this time, we're also talking about The Sweet East, the acclaimed new movie that Sean directed and shot, and which Nick wrote. We talked about shooting particular scenes and working with the film's star, Talia Ryder, who plays a young woman going on a very eventful journey through our complicated country. Ultimately, the conversation turns once again to what Sean and Nick have been watching recently, as well as Sean's other projects. The Sweet East opens on December 1st. Here's our chat, which took place on a crisp autumn day outdoors. This is The Last Thing I Saw, and I'm here with Sean Price Williams and Nick Pinkerton, who have been touring the world on behalf of their film, The Sweet East. Hello, and welcome.
Thank you for having us again.
Yeah, thank you.
We were just discussing that, you know, we recorded an episode, I guess, before or after the genesis of this project. We don't have to time stamp it. But now, of course, you're dripping in jewels.
Yeah, we're very wealthy because of our American independent film.
So where are you just coming from now?
Well, Nick has been doing a lot more touring than I have.
I got back from Mannheim, Heidelberg, day before yesterday. Mm-hmm. And prior to that was in Ljubljana, Slovenia, and Wrocław, Poland.
And, but Sean, you went to Cannes for the world premiere for one thing, right?
Yeah, I did that. Yeah. And then I had a big job that gave me an excuse not to go to a million airports. Nick seems to like traveling like this. I just can't understand it at all.
It's absolutely incorrect, Sean. I'm trying to support the film that we sweated and bled for years and years and give it the best possible chance to find the widest possible audience while you go gad about in Oban, Scotland.
Yeah, we'll get even at some point. I'm going to go to Toronto in a couple weeks and without you, Nick. That's, you know, that I get a few points for that.
Ooh, I'm burning up.
Well, having taken the film, shown the film to different audiences, I am kind of curious, like, what people found in the film that, you know, might have been different than showing it to a U.S. audience.
Yeah, the only American screening I've been to was the New York Film Festival's, our opening there. And it was clear in that screening, clearer than any other, that it's a comedy. And I really appreciated that that feeling, because I had been kind of wondering what it was we'd made. Even after showing in Cannes and other places, and even after winning a couple of awards already by that point, I still didn't really know. You know, not that you have to put a movie into a box, but I didn't know if it was a comedy like I intended or not until we had that screening. Yeah, we had a lot of our friends in the audience, that's true. There were a lot of adults, academics.
Yeah, one thing that's troubled me in showing it abroad is that people don't applaud for Keith Polson quite as much. And I don't know what, I mean, it's one of those sort of cultural sort of misunderstandings. Yeah.
In fact, that always gets a laugh, weirdly. Even though we thought that was the most inside joke in the entire film, it actually does get a laugh.
Do people take it as a satire abroad more than in the States? Or
I think in France, they really look at the problematic characters and they really tear into it a little bit more seriously. Interviews at least suggest this to me. And especially with the neo-Nazi character, whatever, the white supremacist, or whatever they, however they phrase him, this right. Charming and likable, extremely problematic character. I mean, I really think that they are upset by it, even almost some of the French press, at least. That's one big, clear difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought, you know, it just played in Germany finally, and I was really curious if there was how that was going to work out. And I guess
went over gangbusters, I'm sorry to say.
I'm glad. I'm really glad. I felt a little worried leaving Nick there without me.
They gave us an award.
Well, that was a screenwriting award, right? Is that what that
That's
was?
Correct, yes.
That's correct.
That's two you've gotten?
That's two, right.
Yeah.
No. How are you doing?
No director's awards.
No. Talia's Rising Star Award from the Denver Film Festival.
What took so long?
Okay. Yeah, well, she's, I don't know if it was the very first screening at the New York Film Festival, and I mean, it's pretty moving just hearing her talk about basically, like, this was exactly what she wanted to do. She felt, like, more fully, you know, realized. So, I don't know. That must be nice, too.
Yeah, good for her. Meanwhile, she also has a movie playing at, like, every AMC theater in the country, and she's probably actually making money from that.
Craig Gillespie's Dumb Money? Yeah. Is that the film you're referring to?
Yeah, and then it'll be on airplanes. And,
from the Helmer of Mr. Woodcock.
So, that's the Rising Star movie.
It's the GameStop I never really knew what happened with that. Something to do with stocks. And I'll be frank, I don't know exactly what those are.
Can you mention what you were working on in between in the summer? Or
I was shooting a movie that I had promised to do back in 2020 called Harvest, based on the Jim Crace novel. And the director is Athena Sangari. And the producer is Rebecca O'Brien, who works with Ken Loach. Yeah, we shot in Scotland, up in the Highlands. And it was it was pretty thrilling. It's kind of a weird period piece farce. Caleb Landry Jones is in it, and some really wonderful English actors that I was unfamiliar with at the time. They've got a couple of Harry Potter alum in there because you can't not. We had a small country. We had a great time up there.
One out of 10 Britons appeared in Harry Potter.
The crew, whatever. Yeah, I had a really nice time.
Did you ever see that video of, I think it's Kubrick on the set of, I think, Barry Lyndon, like bitching at his UK crew for taking a tea break?
That's not how it is anymore. They're so Americanized by the studios that are over there that there's none of that eccentricity anymore. I'm sad to say.
Uh-huh. I was over there in the quota quickie days.
No, they do have tea, but they don't have anything else, And then they have something called
Iron Brew?
Bovril, which is like a sort of like a beef stock goop that you put in hot water and then you think you're drinking soup. I got really addicted to that.
Are you familiar with Iron Brew?
Yeah, of course.
The orange soda?
Well, they don't brag about it anymore because actually finally in the last few years, Coca-Cola sells more than Iron Brew in Scotland. But it was the other way around forever. But now they've had to face the facts that Coca-Cola rules. Now the entire world.
That's a superior soda pop.
A sad day for Scotland.
Yeah, it's okay.
Another triumph for America.
They've got other things to be happy about. But what's next, though? You were also
where you were headed to next.
I think, I don't know, festival-wise, I know there's still some things ahead.
Well, we're just pimping this thing around the U.S.
The New York release, December 1st, is what we're really focused on, and events to kind of make that exciting and fun. And also, we need to be reminding people that it's playing at least for that whole week at IFC, and we need to actually perform. And then we open in Baltimore, which is in a really amazing, big, giant theater.
The Senator,
which I don't, I don't know what sells out there.
Certainly not our film.
Probably not our film, but let's try to get as many people in there as possible.
We have two screenings on the 8th and 9th.
Baltimore's kind of the hometown for me, even maybe more than New York, as I went to school there and I grew up in Maryland.
Oh, really?
So it means a lot to try to get people there, but I've been away so long, I don't know the kind of the scene or what's going on to tap into.
And then the weekend after that, we have screenings both in Toronto and Philadelphia, the latter at the PFS Bourse.
Very excited about that.
And then we just kind of hold our ground through the holidays and then start the winter campaign.
We go west in January. We've gotten some new news there, which it's not confirmed, but yeah.
Okay.
I was kind of worried that LA was not interested in us because we're called the Sweet East. Maybe there was some bias in the showing.
East-West bias. Well, I thought one thing we could do is maybe just talk about shooting two or three particular scenes. Like, in the very beginning, it's a scene that just opens up a real sense of possibility about the movie. Like, I when this came up, I thought, oh, wow. Anything can happen in a way. And that's when Telly Rider starts singing. Mm. So, yeah, I wonder if you could just talk about, writing it and then shooting it.
I must say I really had nothing to do with the bathroom musical. That was a Sean innovation, I'll just sit my white ass down and listen.
Yeah. Well, that came from my girlfriend and I were watching a movie, a Jenny Agutter film called I Start Counting.
Oh, I know.
And in the beginning there's a song that it's just, you see movies every once in a while, and there's a theme song that you just can't get out of your head for the rest of your life, and that's one of them. And there's that really bad Quiet Days and Clichy movie from the 60s also.
Yeah.
It's got really, it's just a song that just, unfortunately, you can't get out of your head. And I like that idea, because then even if it is a bad movie, you still get that fucking song in your head.
Hey there, Georgie girl.
There's some famous examples, too. More famous.
That's an earworm, definitely, yeah.
But, yeah, earworms. There you go. I got to get these things. Anyway, so, I wanted an earworm. And I know that Paul Grimstad writes songs that are really, to me at least, extremely catchy, but no one really gets to hear them because he doesn't really distribute his music. So I was like, wow, what about this? Put this together. And I know Talia can sing, and she wanted to sing. As soon as I wrote to her, I said, hey, what do you think about this? And to have the lead actress's or actor's voice in the beginning of a film in a song that gets in your head, that you think about throughout the film, and you keep hearing her voice speaking and then singing in your head. And I just think that's kind of this nice echo that happens, maybe. And actually have it, a thing that she sings on camera, seemed like just even the next level to do. And to put her in a bathroom singing to a mirror. It was me and my girlfriend Lizzie. We were just kind of batting it around that night.
And a thing that I hadn't known, I think, until the evening of our New York Film Festival premiere was Paul, which we vary in taste on a number of issues, but we're both great Poe aficionados, is, of course, the Simon Rex character in the movie. And he informed me the title of the song. Did you know this, Sean? That was a journal that Poe had edited for a time and was a major contributor to Evening Mirror.
Paul had like a little demo that he'd already played me before I even had this idea of a song called I'm a Cat. And it's just, I'm a cat, I'm a cat, I'm a cat. I said, well, you know, there's this Poe thing in our movie. Maybe, you know, because I was trying to think, like, I'm a cat, that has nothing to do with our movie. But I was like, wait, there is, Black Cat, okay. Hmm. And then I know Paul's a very well-informed Poe guy, and so he just started to kind of build onto that. I think there's even a couple more little references in there that are above my head.
That's great.
And then filming it, we were kind of avoiding all the little tax breaks that you can get in filming in New York because we wanted to film in all these different states, and we were like, we don't care about tax breaks. We're making this movie the way we want to make it. But if you film in a studio one day in New York, you get a little break. So I said, well, in fact, I do want to build the bathroom.
We built two bathrooms.
We built the one where she takes a bath in, too, on the same set right next door. And
the monastery.
The monastery is also on that stage. So it was a big stage day. We had to do all that in a half a day because then we had to go and rehearse and shoot Gibby, which we knew we needed a little bit of time for. So the bathroom got kind of rushed. I think that we spent more time graffitiing up that room than we did shooting it.
Oh, really?
I think we did maybe 8 takes of her just moving around the space, like on the toilet, at the sink.
Popping zits in the mirror.
You know, reading graffiti, writing. We really just didn't know what the fuck we were doing.
Yeah.
And then I think Craig was like, which was very rare, Craig was like, I really think we need to get this and move on because we need some time with Gibby. So we kind of just like, let's just do one just totally in the mirror where you're just looking at yourself and the camera. And that's it. And we did that one take. And I was like, ooh, that's cool. We'll use most of that probably.
Yeah.
And then we just used the whole thing.
That's amazing. I've never quite understood how you shoot with mirrors or how that works.
The very first movie I did in New
York.
You just
kind of keep your reflection out of the mirror.
Yeah. Well, but then how does it look like they're looking at themselves?
Yes,
or do they look
at
them? Yeah, I mean, that's always a thing we ask. Like, that's one of these beautiful things that, you know, that Joseph Losey plays with and all these, you know, famously.
Fassbender.
Yeah, Fassbender.
Known
oh my
to
God.
Shoot a mirror from time to time. Chinese Roulette, I think there's not a single shot in that that isn't
that's not
like
in
a mise en abyme. Yeah.
I think there's an exterior maybe. But yeah, there's the bathroom in Year of 13 Moons, that bathroom with all those square mirrors all over it. I don't know how they did. That's a nightmare. Yeah, it's a beautiful gift. And the first movie I did in New York was this movie called 12, and it was all first person. The entire movie's first person. So to prepare, we played a lot of Goldeneye. The director and I, and then we played.
In which you can play Gottfried John.
Yeah,
to go back
awesome,
to Fassbender.
Go back to Fassbender connection there. Yeah, isn't that amazing? I wonder if only Fassbender would have been around to play that video game, see his friends.
That's really the one thing I regret about his premature death.
We have another movie that's slightly inspired by Goldeneye, which we'll talk about later, maybe. Where you know what I'm talking about.
You're talking about Peeping Dead?
Yeah. Okay. Later. Okay. Anyway, so whatever. You know, we learned a lot about what you can get away with and how and this and that. It's always a fun trick. Just try to keep your elbow out of them.
Robert Montgomery, Lady in the Lake.
We watched that before I did that movie too.
Oh, yeah.
And
Ride the Pink Horse has.
And
like
we didn't watch
overture that is largely first person.
We watched the 32 or whatever, the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for those. Great sequences where he's moving and he's looking in mirrors and stuff and that, which is a...
And then Wells's first movie was meant to be like Heart of Darkness that was all first person. before he got on Citizen Kane, he was developing a Heart of Darkness adaptation that was all meant to be first person. Yeah. I think there's camera tests that exist. Oh,
it was not a good idea back then when you have those big cameras rolling around. It's just not how...
Yeah, it tends to make me think of that Saturday Night Live series, The Continental.
That's much better.
When I think of that.
Much better example.
And just to kind of pull back a bit, I mean, how much do you sketch at all? How you're going to frame a scene or shoot a scene, or is that more things that happen on the day? Or
we did a storyboard for the massacre scene.
Okay,
that was it.
I wanted to ask about that scene.
Yeah, we had a day to shoot all that. At the time, we had a stunt guy and a weapons guy that told us, "There's no way you're going to be able to do this in a day." And we, let's prove it. Okay, well, how can we prove? Well, let's get the storyboards. They'll respond to that. And then they quit because the rust incident happened, and they...
It was like 2 weeks before, I think.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow.
So okay. they went on to be extra arms dealers on those bigger movies that had a little more to offer them.
Okay.
And they left us to our own devices.
Which is why our white supremacists have these extremely unconvincing Vietnam-era, like M16s.
Yeah. All the guns were wrong. God bless the our props guy that, you know, made these choices that I didn't. But we included it in the scene a little bit where Io is the director, who's very unhappy with the guns.
This is not a gun. I've never seen a gun. Yeah, this is stupid.
Like minutes before that was me when I saw the guns that were given to us for the same scene. So
okay.
Yeah.
Well, I was actually going to ask about that scene.
The same kind of decisions that we chose to shoot that time of year because we were promised snow. And we got up there, and it was basically T-shirt and shorts weather.
Okay.
This is in November.
We got a little blow around toward the end of the shoot, if you'll recall.
Yeah, too late. But so then we included that in the film, too, where Jeremy's like, you know, trying to get a guy to get him convincing snow.
Well, that, in point of fact, was something you had suggested to me, because you had some anecdote about a shoot where, you know, some like equipment guy came up with... just these sort of white carpets that were meant to imply snow.
In Marjorie Prime. I'll name names, you know, whatever. Yeah, our snow in that when we shot was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever seen in my life. they fixed it up.
Marjorie Prime. That's the one about the AI.
Yeah. Yeah, wanting to like live well past your death. Like, what a dream.
Neither of you are interested in that? Or?
Nope.
Okay.
I would like to have passed on some years ago, if humanly possible.
No, but about shooting and then, like, you know, preparing sort of, like, visually, whatever. Uh-huh. I mean, yeah, normally when my job is solely as a DOP, I will, you know, come with some ideas. This time I wasn't having that kind of conversation with myself as much, and I was much more focused on the directing and how do I talk to actors, you know, thing. And a crew and all that stuff that a director does that I, you know, hadn't really been in charge of before. So this one was a little bit more, you know, I had like a shot for the audition scene with Io and Jeremy in mind, which is behind their afros, you know, sort of slowly zooming in on Talia. I was like, this is going to be how the whole scene plays out. Okay, great. You know, so each scene I had like kind of like a loose idea like that.
Yeah. In terms of talking with actors, and I mean, you shot this over different seasons to get the real feel of each season.
Yeah, even though it's probably about a 10-degree difference.
Yeah, and it's also, along with all the highly difficult things that we did, such as shooting locations for locations, something noticed by practically nobody who's seen the film.
No, it's sad. I know, it took us so long to get Philadelphia to even screen our movie, and especially we went all the way down there just for two shots. Just we were so, you know, proud to show this to Philadelphians that we did their city right. We didn't like fake Bushwick for Philadelphia.
But I mean, when you're over that extended period of time, and you know, talking with Talia about her character, for example, like, were there changes or like developments in what, you know, she was bringing to it after a while, or like, did she kind of have new ideas about the character as the shoot went along? Or
I feel like I've gone over the top with my reverence for Talia.
Yeah, I think it's time to kind of knock her down a peg, frankly. Ever since she got that Rising Star Award at the Denver Film Festival, she's been kind of swanning about like she owns the fucking place.
Yeah, no, she's really incredible. And when we were still casting, she was asking questions about her character in the script that showed kind of like a seriousness and sort of a challenge to at least me, even my, and my understanding of the character that I was pretty excited by. And, you know, Nick and I, when we talked about the movie early on to people, we would say, you know, kind of foolishly, well, whatever actress we get to play this part, she's going to make the character believable, you know, which is a really, I know it's a lame kind of point of view for director and writer to take, but we did count on it. She more than delivered.
Yeah, I would say one thing that was evident about Talia from jump, I mean, just from the audition tapes that she sent in, or audition videos that she sent in, I should say, is she really set her cap for this movie and really had her eye on this part, and I think had the entire movie in her head to a really advanced degree, which, I mean, you know, being less involved in the day-to-day than Sean was, but as a, someone at least being on set, was just an enormous relief. And Talia, I think, is somebody who's very smart about how she's conducting her career, and this was something she really wanted to do.
Yeah.
And she could probably have a IMDb credit list that's three times longer than it presently is, but she's selective about the things that she does, and when she does a thing, commits to it enormously. And I mean, what a absolute blessing that is for the both of us. And a thing that's kind of occurred to me touring the movie around is, you know, Sean is, this is his first time solo feature directorial credit. This is my first time screenwriting credit. Talia's been on stage since she was 12 years old. So in some regard, she's more experienced doing the particular job that she's doing here than either of us are. So we were fortunate in having a old pro to carry us.
Yeah, and we shot the second half first, which was, you know, a good idea, except that she's, you know, she's young and shooting 6 months after the first half of the movie.
Yeah, she'd aged terribly.
I was a little worried, you know, and then she went to Poland and did another movie. I said, she's going to come back and she's going to, like, look more grown up. Somehow she even looks younger. She's that much in control of the characters. No, but shooting her that first week and a half or so, even, I got so many different looks, and still when I watch it, I just am so blown away by how many different kind of faces and people that she embodies there.
Yeah, and I would say a thing that's probably become increasingly evident to me, and Sean, I think you'd probably agree with this, is because she is so effortlessly gives the appearance of being natural, acting natural. And when we started the shoot, neither Sean nor myself knew Talia all that terribly well. And I think there was, at least on my part, a tendency to kind of take for granted that she just was. And as, you know, the years have gone by and we've gotten to know her better, what really blows me away is how much she had created an entire physical vocabulary for this character who's very much not herself, and was able to give that impression of spontaneity that's actually full of calculation and thought and, you know, sort of intelligent decision making.
I mean, it strikes me as like a very challenging character.
And she also has to play a, you know, an actor,
right?
You know, so then that's, you know, how do you play a maybe a bad actor, or at least an inexperienced actor, as an actor who is not really yet known herself, without just looking like she's a bad actor? And I think that was early on in the shoot too, and that really impressed the hell out of me, how she gives these little winks and nods. She always says, you know, it was like we were making like five different movies, and she got to sort of just play different characters and all those. That was kind of how I think she looked at it.
Yeah, an actor playing a bad actor, it's like, reminds me of one of, I think, the most difficult tasks that an actor can take on is playing a moron and not kind of letting slip that they're a little brighter than the character that they're playing. And that's, I mean, one of the magnificent things about Warren Oates is when Warren Oates plays a fucking idiot, you believe that this guy has not two brain cells to rub together.
In terms of what the movie, like the picture the movie makes of like the country and just people kind of being all over the place and none of the options seeming particularly great, you know, is one way you phrased it as well. Are things still getting worse? Or is this like a snapshot where we'll look back and we're like, actually, at least it hadn't gotten even worse or something?
I don't think it's getting worse. I think it's just, I think, you know, I'm waiting for this beautiful moment that finally brings us together. I don't know what that's going to be. It's going to be something that none of us could anticipate, and it's going to be powerful, but it is going to happen. We're all ready for it. Everyone's so passionate. I mean, these arguments that we are witnessing right now, and, you know, and it's just more proof of, you know, just this kind of like this displaced passion that is what makes me really proud of America, actually, in general. And, you know, it leads to foolishness, and it also leads to brilliance and dreams. And, you know, I don't know. I just watched a couple episodes from the new John Wilson, the third series. And that show also, it's all it does for me is, just, God, I'm so delighted to be, you know, American. I've so much more I need to do as an American to be as impressive as these just incredible characters that he finds. And I don't know, it's just like, I really love that show, and I think he should get like a presidential award or something, because no matter how nutty or even dumb they seem, they're just like, these Americans are living with all this bullshit that we're being given right now, and these arguably terrible economic times and everything, but we're just still kind of chugging along, finding our weird ways to just make it, you know, and get through it. And I think it's really admirable. And, it, you know, I don't think we're close to a civil war, actually, or any of this stuff that people like to say. But there is something that's got to happen to make us love each other again a little bit more. If we ever did, you know, I don't know. I have like a fake maybe image that once upon a time, like when we were children, that everybody did get along. You know, you watch Killer of Sheep and the Eagle Pinnell film, a whole shooting match.
Oh, yeah.
Same year. Two totally different, you know, groups, types of people, whatever, but they're the same. They're wearing the same shirts. They're wearing the same hats. They got the same problems, you know, black and white, like just poor America. And I was like, wow, isn't this nice? You know, everyone's
like a depiction of a working class that's been so
strategically
decimated.
Yeah.
And I mean that decimation was already well underway at that point,
right.
But it's kind of the last gasp of,
this is my first, you know, awareness, though it was in this period, you know, as a human being. So I kind of feel like, well, there's something that can bring us back together. Maybe it's just a collapse of something from the top,
or maybe it's
know.
A little motion picture called maybe the Sweet East.
I always call it the moonwalk moment, like when Michael Jackson did the moonwalk, and every single person in America the next day, it's all they talked about. And it was just so exciting and moving. It was just a simple thing.
Yeah.
I've just never seen a man walk backwards in quite that fashion before.
Exactly. Even though it had been done before, he didn't invent that. There's some YouTube clips from television. Yeah, but I mean, you know, whatever. Michael Jackson did it better. Okay.
Don't come around here talking about Bob fucking Fosse doing Snake in the Grass and the goddamn Little Prince movie. This guy was wearing a hat because of his fucking hairline.
Well, let's get to the titular.
I'm pretty excited about
exercise,
this.
Which is the last things you've seen.
Since we're here together, I think the last thing that Nick and I watched together, we didn't quite we watched a Phillies game, which they lost, but before that we had been watching a movie called Hollywood Harry, which we sort of, I had just watched it entirely, and I was excited to show Nick.
Robert Forster's lone directorial effort?
Yeah, starring him and his daughter.
Wait, who's the lone? Who?
Robert Forster.
Oh, really? I haven't
seen
that.
Yeah, in the 80s, okay. Him and Joe Spinell.
Treat yourself.
Okay. Yeah.
Hollywood Harry.
The problem is I watch these things on my tablet on an airplane or in my hotel room alone, and I think, wow, this is really something. You know, I got to show Nick. And so we tried Hollywood Harry, and
I gotta say, it wasn't really sticking to the ribs.
Right. But but just before that, we did finish a film together that I had also seen like the night before, called Mr. Patman with James Coburn. It's a Canadian movie about a sort of a depressed male nurse.
Mr. Batman?
Patman.
Oh, Patman.
P for Pac-Man.
Oh, Pac-Man.
Patman. Yeah,
Patman, okay.
Yeah. And Nick did stick through that. We got through that one together. And
I can't believe there's like 10 movies about Batman now, but there's only one about Mr. Patman.
I'm trying to raise awareness. I'd love it if maybe, you know, someone would put it out on Blu-ray, because it's just a VHS rip that exists right now.
Wait, when is that from in his
1980.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember. It's like one of these, Is it Gillerman? One of these guys, like John Gierman, or one of these guys whose name you see on mostly forgettable movies. But I think this is, I don't know, it's just something about it haunts me, still haunts me.
What happens to him, or what is he?
Not a great deal.
He's like in a mental hospital with these sexy women that are kind of like...
He starts to unravel a bit himself.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
The general mania of the atmosphere starts to infest Mr. Patman.
Yeah, and his relationships with other people, it just breaks apart. And it's one of those movies. I don't know what section it goes in the video store, unless you have a Canada shelf. But it has the box cover suggests it's a horror movie. And it is a little bit, it's creepy if you watch it alone in a hotel room, far from home. So that was our last movie we watched together. Yeah.
And individually, did you?
I think the last thing that I watched was on my flight back here from Frankfurt, Steven Spielberg's Lincoln.
Oh. Well.
Which I had not watched since its initial release. And I'd forgotten how, like, chock-a-block with character actors it is.
Oh, okay.
And particularly... some really good facsimiles as we sit in Seward Park, of all places, some very good facsimiles of prominent individuals during the great struggle between the states, particularly Jackie Earle Haley, who later went on to be the Freddy Krueger in the Nightmare on Elm Street remake, among other things, is really fantastic as Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy.
Oh.
And like everyone, when watching in-flight movies, I'm particularly susceptible to the pull of emotion. And I remember talking about this particular phenomenon with Andy Lampert, late of Anthology, and him talking about exactly watching Lincoln on a plane and just saying, like, in the middle of, like, you know, the first scene, he's like, I just started welling up, and I just started thinking, he's such a good guy. Why'd they have to do him like that?
Yeah.
So, yeah, just fucking bawling my eyes out about the terrible treatment that came to our 16th president.
How do you think it holds up to the Griffith?
The Griffith is phenomenal,
which
I believe is his first sound picture, followed only by The Struggle. And one of the many extraordinary things about the Griffith is very early in the film, if I recall, there is a depiction of a slave ship in the Middle Passage. Oh. And I don't know... of many, if any, films of the 1930s or 40s where you see those images at all. And I'm fully aware of the problematic legacy of Mr. Griffith. But I find those images extraordinary for their very existence, but also for the concentrated power that they have. And it's Walter Huston as Honest Abe, who's a bit short for the role, frankly.
Okay.
And a bit Canadian as well. But nobody's perfect.
Visually, that film is really incredible. I mean, there's when I actually was kind of shooting stuff from it off my TV at some point when I was coming up with like a weird montage sequence for the movie that we never really followed through with. But I just couldn't believe how many... just amazing images are in that thing. It's one after another. But I mean, you know, this is why we like him.
Wait, for the Sweet East?
It was going to be like
a montage?
Yeah, I got a bunch of flags and some Abraham Lincoln. You know, the amount of
dumb shit we came up with and discarded in the course of this.
Well, because we couldn't decide whether it was done or not until Can said, okay, we want to play it. And said, okay, let's not fuck around. Let's stop. Yeah,
stop
okay,
tinkering.
Right, there we were done.
I forget who it is who said movies are never finished, just abandoned.
Yeah.
I've heard that. As time goes on and everything changes around the movies are changed. I mean,
right.
So it's true. They aren't finished. I mean, did my top 1,000 list. And I mean, the movies haven't changed. You would think the movies haven't changed, but I have changed. So then my experience of the movies changed. This is really profound stuff.
Do you want to put in a plug for the forthcoming publication of the top 1,000?
Metrograph is publishing my top 1,000 movie list, finally. I couldn't decide on it because it's always changing. Because always, you know,
it's always changing in this very funny way where Sean's like, yeah, I took Badlands out so I could put Jess Franco's 1986 Macumba Sexual.
Not an example, actually, but, you know, Macumba Sexual is not in there. Yeah, I know.
So this is
not a quality thing. It's just like, what, you know, I don't know. It's what my experiences are, I guess, you know. And Patman is not in there either.
Okay. Yet.
This is going to be like a bound thing?
It's going to be like an actual physical thing, a small little guy, kind of based on the Green Integer. They did a little notes on cinematography, you know, that was like it goes in your pocket.
Uh-huh. It's a little catechism for film lovers.
Yeah, okay. Like having your pocket and there's a little room you can write notes and things like that. You can say this movie sucks or whatever, just to yourself. I encourage that.
That also seems like an endless project.
Right, because movies, yeah, exactly. It is. As long as I'm alive, it's going to change. And that's what's exciting about the thing. It's like I'm just looking forward to the changes and seeing more movies that just... Because I'm still like, I'm just forever searching for the new favorite movie of my life, you know? The last movie that I watched...
Oh, yeah, just yourself.
This morning, I was watching some Russian animation films. I pulled out this Chinese box set I got years ago of, you know, Masters of Russian Animation. And some of that stuff is, you know, kind of beautiful. There's a spy spoof one, I can't remember what it's called, like Story of a Spy or something like that, that was kind of surprising. This Russian's making fun of James Bond movies and then like making fun of, actually I don't know, this might even be before like Boris and Natasha and stuff like that, but it's that kind of thing. It's coming from the Russian point of view. That's cool. And I also watched yesterday, I watched a movie called Riviera, which John Frankenheimer directed for TV, though he used Alan Smithy pseudonym.
Was that when Frankenheimer was still on The Sauce? Or
I would say for sure, yeah.
Those movies have a real particular quality.
Like Holcroft Covenant, we watched a week ago. What a stinker, but it's just, you know.
What's the one with Michael Caine? It's like 44, it's like...
99, 44, 100%
dead. Yes, thank you.
And The Challenge with Scott Glenn, you know, but 52 pickups in the middle of all that, too, so... Sometimes they work. But yeah, this one was so rare. It's so rare.
How rare is it?
It's so rare. You cannot find it anywhere. I dare anybody to find it anywhere online. Any town download of it, anything. What we had is this tape, though, that was taped off of a TV broadcast that it's going to be back in the Kim's collection. I was renting it. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to return it on Friday. But it's so rare that I actually watched it again today and fast forward just to make sure I registered everything. There's kind of an amazing shot with like a sphinx. They go to Egypt, you know, towards the end of the movie, and there's like a shot where they're in a pyramid or a tomb, and out this hole you just see a sphinx at sunset, and it's just so beautiful and so fake looking. But I know it's going to be in my head forever. And also, I really wanted to see John Finch again because he's really on The Sauce. He's got a really cool mullet and these flip up sunglasses, and I should have taken some pictures, but
really nothing exemplifies how depressing England in the 70s was as much as John Finch at the beginning of Frenzy, where he just steals a little tot of scotch and then gets bounced out of his barman job.
Yeah.
The drab crapness of 70s England, I think, has never been exemplified more. Talking of 52 pickup, we should mention that at one point we were both so hot to have John Glover in the role eventually played by Gibby Haynes. John Glover, who in 52 pickup plays, I think, cinema's foremost, if not only, like Baltimorean heavy.
Well, I would say even more like bottom of the Eastern Shore, where he's from. He lays on an accent.
Yeah, great taste in women's sport.
It's more than any John Waters, performance. Actually, it's so it's the thickest Maryland accent that I've ever heard, and it's pretty thrilling. We were excited to get him involved with the movie. We thought he would definitely go for it, and he said no.
Well, at one point, I even rewrote the lines so that he would say he was from Salisbury, thinking that would be a honey trap that no actor could resist.
Yeah. Wow. Nothing. We had a lot of people we went after that for that role.
Yeah.
Randy West, the porn performer that I have a real affection for, he actually said, oh, I'd really love to do it, but I'm just not in any shape to travel. That was the most positive.
Chuck Wepner. at one point.
Right. Yeah, right.
The Bayonne bleeder, Chuck Wepner, the real-life Rocky.
We thought it was going to be a real opportunity for someone, but
yeah. And it turned out to be.
And just so people know which character this is, it's the
monk towards the end abbot. Of the film. Yeah, the abbot.
The abbot. I don't want to start a whole new topic here, but just because of the use a model for the castle. But that also reminded me of the Schuften effect that you use for when she's Telly's walking through the sort of nature, basically.
Yeah, and they land with
wrist shaw,
They land in a painting.
A painting,
magically.
Yeah.
Very old technique.
Which we brought up to a high level of perfection, dare say.
Yeah.
I love it. It's a magical look.
That was day one of the shoot, and we exposed ourselves to the entire crew, what kind of knuckleheads we were, and what kind of movie we were making, maybe a little bit. And I'm really happy about that in hindsight, that we tried to do that the first day. It was kind of, a brave thing, because we did not know whether it was going to work at all. We did zero tests, zero, measuring of any kind. And all the things that you really needed to do to make that work, we hadn't done. So we were preparing for a total failure in front of the entire crew on day one, which also would have been cute, if we just blew it. I don't know. Yeah.
And the entire reasoning for its existence is there's next to no visual direction in the script. A couple things here and there, but there's, none like the camera pans, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the few pieces that was there was they come to an overlook, and it looks like this painting, Kindred Spirits, by the Hudson Valley painter Asher B. Duran.
Okay.
And during the initial scout, there was nothing that vaguely looked like that. Okay. And so I'm like, we'll just Schuften process.
Yeah, because I'm so literal that if I see that painting reference, I say, that means it has to be that in the movie, That's how I read scripts, very literally. I say, how are we going to? So that's why it happened.
I didn't realize that was the first day. Okay.
Very first day. That whole sequence is the first thing we shot, their walk in nature, which is lovely how it's played by them.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it a lot. I just want to pick up one last thread that you mentioned, since you mentioned that, was it Riviera? Was a Kim's, that project, you could talk a bit about that.
I asked a couple friends, I said, guys, what do you think matters more to me, the success of Sweet East or the success of the Kim's video rehabilitation, as far as people's awareness and just, And my friends know where my sentiments lie here.
Yeah, it's really obvious. And the promotion you've done thus far.
And, I don't know how to get anybody to come to the four floors underground in Wall Street to this video store that we've set up now. I stand in the middle of these tapes that we put out. We put out probably 1,200 or 1,500, maybe more tapes just in the last, 6 months. And there's a lot more matched and ready to go out there. We just don't have the space for it, I guess, right now. So we're going to build shelves and things like that. But it's unthinkable to be like a serious about cinema and not not use this archive. It's free. And the things that we've been coming up with, and because I'm very aware of availability and lack of so many things that are really important to me and all of us guys working at the store, and also just loving movies. And it's kind of crazy the things that are dropping off. It's a real treat just to even stand there and look at just going through the tapes. I've already discovered them 10 times in my life, and now they're out on the floor, and then I go down there and I just am surrounded by them, and I'm pulling them off the shelves and you can't get me out of there. It's just so pleasing, and you can actually take these things home and watch these movies, including Riviera, that I swear you cannot. And I'm out there. I'm a pirate. I know what's out there. Anyway.
Yeah.
Patrick Bauchau and John Finch. And it's a good movie. Anyhow.
Film history is vast and bottomless.
Yes, it is. And people can take these out now,
You can go down there, bring your credit card, and just put it down, and then you rent the movies for free. And please don't steal them, because it's no point.
Yeah.
Just watch once at normal and then watch it again and fast forward so you remember everything.
Okay, that's the patented Sean Price Williams technique.
As far as something in the theater.
The Patman.
Did you see The Strangler yet, the Vecchiali thing?
The Vecchiali? Yeah,
I've seen it. And they're playing
We played it at Metrograph a little while back. It's a very high masterpiece.
Yeah, I think it stinks.
Well,
you don't like it?
No, not at all.
I'm not crazy about it.
I like when he's walking and he's having these weird flashbacks of violent things in the streets.
Oh yeah.
That the filmmaking there is so cool and so exciting that why did I have to watch an hour of horribly lit, everything in France in the 70s looks horrible. The movies look so bad to me. The light, everything is, every single corner is just overlit. The camera movement in this movie is so clumsy and like just busted. There's, you see the whole fat crew in like 10 shots reflected, and they just look like they're just fat and smoking and ugly, and it just like, it looks like just a nightmare to make it. Bad ideas, overrated. He's not an important new discovery.
There's not a single Vecchiali you rate.
Everyone, I'm so disappointed. I'm like ready for it to be over after like 10 minutes.
Yeah. What about, maybe he just produced this, but what about Simon Barbez?
Yeah, that's cool. He didn't direct it.
He didn't direct. He just, no, it was a diagonal.
Yeah, I mean, he was in a crowd of these cool guys that I, you know, like I know my friend, like my friends in France have been Vecchiali, Biet, and Guiguet. These are like the, they're like the real great filmmakers that no one knows. Yeah, okay, right. And now we get, now we're getting a little taste of it over here.
Well, I think no small part of the cachet that Diagonal has is it's kind of the last gasp of an actually independent, cinema that exists outside of like state sponsored financing and.
Yeah, it's independent. So if you don't have the means to move that camera in any convincing way, just set it down and, you know.
I like a nice little visit from the crew from time to time.
It's exactly the kind of movie that I should love, you know. Mm-hmm. And if I hadn't seen it in the theater, I would buy the Blu-ray instantly because I would assume that I would love it. You know what I mean? And then,
right.
But I'm so glad I got to see it, and I don't have to have it on my shelf.
You don't have to take up space with
except if the Blu-ray comes out and it's got, like, a short or something rare, then I got to get it anyway.
Do you know the Muriel Spark novel, The Driver's Seat, by any chance?
Yeah.
It
I've been reading
dovetails,
a lot of
oh, yeah, of yeah. course. Yeah. The fucking queen. Yeah. But it like dovetails in an interesting way, I think, with The Driver's Seat and this kind of study in semi-willing feminine self-sacrifice. So maybe just because I'd been in a spark hole, The Strangler was hitting very nicely with me.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it.
I enjoy the garishly overlit cinematography of
The Driver's Seat adaptation, film adaptation, is in the top 1,000.
Ah.
And, is photographed. I mean, it's some of the greatest photography of that era, for sure. And it's Storaro. Okay. You know, but yeah, it's
incredible. Same director as Tis Pity She's a Whore. Yeah,
that's right, which we showed at City Dudes. We have another City Dudes coming up also. We have a couple planned. Oh, another movie that we watched together recently, Nick and I, was our City Dudes in Ghent, Belgium.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Which we played.
Thierry Zeno's Vastenos.
Vastenos.
Oh, I haven't seen
also
that.
Known as the pig fucking movie.
Or The Wedding Trough.
Or The Wedding Trough, yeah. We got to show a print, 16mm print.
The director's own, yeah.
With his children in attendance. They're not kids anymore. They're fantastic adults. We showed it, and we sat in the front row just drinking and having the time of our life. And as soon as the pig sex started happening, we heard many footsteps running out of the room.
Very creaky chairs in that theater.
Yeah, when the seats flipped up, you really heard it. It was kind of...
Every defection was really palpable. Really. And then Zeno's kids, daughter and son, who were both, I think, in their mid-20s, were so sweet and, like, so sort of overwhelmed at the gesture that these two moron Americans had blundered their way into the Kingdom of Belgium and seen fit to like blindside an audience with their father's movie about pig fucking. It was really a special evening, and I recall, I think around the time that the first retreat started, and you know, we'd already, you know, showed the movie and we'd been traveling with the movie for a little while, but we were playing the pig fucking movie for a unsuspecting paying audience. I just leaned over to Sean like, you know, this is what we did all of this for, and he's like, I know.
So clear.
He's the De Moore guy as well, right?
Yeah, which is a really awesome movie.
Yeah, that's also
He's a really cool looking guy back, and you know, I look at pictures of him, he's like, just looks like somebody that we would have maybe been lucky to be friends with, you know.
Well, like De Moore, he co-directed with, it's two other people who are also on Vastenos, Dominique Garny. I think it's actually the star of Vastenos is a credited co-director.
Doesn't Nick look like late Jean Eustache these days? Isn't it amazing?
Well, I hope to finish very much like he did.
Jeez, we're back to that talk now. Come on.
Knock loudly to wake the dead.
Well, we can bring things in for a landing. I did want to ask, I was curious if either of you had seen the Martin Scorsese movie.
Yeah. And
if you want to say a few words about that.
I've written about it.
Have you? Oh.
Yes, for four columns.
Oh, okay. Well,
and I was paid handsomely.
You're paid.
And I'm getting bupkis for sitting here right now.
Right.
And I am still waiting for somebody to pay me to watch it. The trailer was pretty thrilling. I don't know. I know it's going to be unnecessarily drawn out, and I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how to get excited about it now that it's actually out.
Right.
Looking forward to it.
It's no Mr. Padman, ultimately.
Yeah.
A few films are, though. So.
Yeah, I'm basically watching movies for time travel, and I even if it's a movie that takes place in another time, movies that are made today look so much the same and so much just like today, and it's really hard for me to get excited.
Yeah.
I really regret this, but...
Well, I think we can bring things to an ending there.
Let's do it another 3.5 years, approximately.
3.5 years, we'll check in then.
When Peeping Dad is coming to a theater near you.
Thanks for sitting down, taking the time.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Yeah.
Congrats again.
Good night and good luck.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.